In a way, I'm a little, I'm sorry I wasn't at the, I didn't show up to the previous talk, because I actually know Horgan and I know Key Davidson. Both of these guys, and I think it came out in the talk, took a lot of flack for what they were doing. But what I want to talk about here is actually the kind of flack that Nobel Prize winners take, okay? And this has to do with issues of heterodoxy and the way in which the Nobel Prize actually facilitates and enables heterodoxy. And the reason why I called my talk initially the Watson-Crick parallax was because Watson and Crick, who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1962, right, are guys who went off after getting the Nobel Prize for discovering the double helix structure of DNA, went on to do quite different sorts of things, both of which in their own way were quite controversial. The reason why I dropped the initial title was I had forgotten that Morris Wilkins, which you mentioned, was also awarded the Nobel Prize, but he also fits the thesis that I'm arguing here, namely another heterodox thinker, okay? So in 1962, we have these three guys getting the Nobel Prize for discovering the structure of the double helix of DNA, and all of them, in a way, went off in quite different directions that I think some people, at least, would say are not particularly scientific, but in a way, the Nobel Prize enabled this by giving them the kind of things that you were talking about, the sense of excellence, right, the sort of reputation, the visibility, all this kind of stuff. And so my little thesis that, in a way, I want to explore here with you is the idea this is what the Nobel Prize ought to be doing, right? In other words, it shouldn't be just an unintended consequence of giving the Nobel Prize, but it should be something that perhaps should be more directly associated with the prize itself. The way I want to start by doing this is by thinking about the Nobel Prize in the most general sort of sense. Because one of the things I've always had a problem with the Nobel Prize, so I was invited by Sven to be part of this conference, but I'm not a natural constituent of the Nobel Prize fan club, because I don't think the Nobel Prize is much of a prize, okay? Especially if we understand prize in a relatively strict sense. Namely, a prize is something that's done for, where you have kind of a goal, and the goal is specified in advance, and then the question becomes, who's the first one who gets there, who does it best? So in other words, the goal is really clearly defined. And so during the Enlightenment, which was the great period when there were prizes in science, right, the idea was who's going to be the first person to refute this? Who's going to be the first person to prove that? Right? And then you can judge the various entries, and you can put a date by which the thing needs to be done. And sometimes it would be the one who gets closest or something of that kind. And that's the basis on which you would talk about a prize. And when we talk about Olympics, for example, there's something similar going on there as well, where there's a clear sense of what you're working toward. And, you know, the competition is very clearly defined. Okay? The Nobel Prize isn't really like that. Nobel Prize is much looser from the standpoint of being a prize. Because what exactly are you competing for? I mean, I've heard people use the word competition here a lot as talking about what the Nobel Prize is about. And certainly the scientists who have been involved in the whole Nobel Prize business certainly have seen themselves as competing against each other. But what, other than just getting the prize, right, what actually is the substantive goal? Okay, what is the substantive goal? It's not clear. Right? What is clear, of course, is the different fields in which the Nobel Prize is defined. Right? We've got these different disciplines, but we don't just have disciplines, do we? We've got literature, we've got peace. Okay? And those aren't quite disciplines either. And if you look at how, in fact, the prize is selected, and I think you alluded to this in some of your remarks, right, the prize is not just people from within the discipline it's people who can come from other disciplines, who may be members of the Royal Academy here, right, who could, or people who are even invited ad hoc to make nominations, right? I mean, so from that standpoint, it's really loose. It's not really a prize in the strict sense at all. So you sort of wonder, what are people competing for here exactly, okay? So I've always been a bit bemused about the fact that the Nobel Prize is regarded as a prize. Okay, it's a reward for something, but a prize? I'm not so sure exactly. And especially given, if you think about the time lag between when the stuff is done and when you actually get the prize, that can vary enormously. Now, the interesting thing, of course, about the guys who got it for the double helix structure of DNA is they were relatively young when they got the prize. They, two of them, I believe, were in their 40s, and Watson was still in his 30s, I think. So the double helix structure is discovered in 1953, and the Nobel Prize is awarded in 1962. Okay, so that actually gave them a lot of time to do other stuff. Okay, and they did. Right, and that's kind of the interesting issue here. The thing that I said in the abstract that is kind of relevant to the thesis here that I'm arguing is that I regard the Nobel Prize it's not really a prize in a discipline in the classical sense. In fact, most academic disciplines nowadays, often through their professional societies, have awards and prizes for people who are contributing to the discipline. They're already there, okay? The Nobel Prize is doing something else. And what I would argue is that it's kind of it's what I would call a liberal intervention in the knowledge system. It's disruptive, right? And in a sense, it should be self-consciously understood as disruptive rather than just accidentally disruptive, okay? Because I think at the moment, the disruptive character of the Nobel Prize is kind of seen as an interesting curiosity. But in fact, that might be kind of where the action is as far as where this prize can make a difference. And of course, the thing that makes the disruptive character of the Nobel Prize so interesting is, of course, a lot of money's attached to it, right? So it has the power to be disruptive. Whereas, of course, if you get disciplinary awards by being the most notable person in your field who wrote the best article or something like that, you're usually not getting the amount of money we're talking about here. Right, so in a sense, what normally happens within a disciplinary context is that, you know, in a sense you're rewarded for staying within the discipline, but, you know, no one's, you know, you have no reason basically to leave or do something different or think about yourself in new terms or anything like that. But as we've seen already from the papers here, right, one of the consequences of getting the Nobel Prize is you immediately become some kind of public figure. Some more successful than others for various reasons. But in a sense, you're already given that, right? That comes along with the prize. And so there's a sense in which the Nobel Prize, it strikes me, is disruptive. It is by its nature a disruptive activity. It does not necessarily, I don't know, maybe someone might want to do some research on this or maybe has some research on this. Does this actually promote the conduct of academic disciplines in which the prizes are being given? Does it actually do that? I don't know. I don't know of any work that suggests this, but what I do think it does is it actually opens up opportunities for people, very smart people, who've done significant things within their own fields to do something else, okay? And the other things that they do, the interesting thing about this, and this is why I focus on, Watson and Crick and Wilkins, is because these are guys who, in a sense, you begin to see why they went into biology, right? You know, in a sense, they get the Nobel Prize for something quite specific, for discovering the double helix structure of DNA. That's quite a specific thing. That was something that by the time they were working on, people were trying to figure out because everybody realized DNA was very important. But if you look at how they all got into biology, and two of them actually came from physics, you begin to realize that, in fact, they were thinking about this in the very beginning in a broader kind of way. And then when they kind of managed to get a kind of notable success through DNA, again, the opportunities were opened up again to pursue those broader reasons that drove them into science in the first place, which went beyond the disciplinary confines. Okay, so all three guys, one of the things they have in common, so Watson's the biologist, and the other two, Crick and Wilkins, are physicists by training. What they all have in common is that they were very much impressed by Schrödinger's What is Life lectures in Dublin, 1942-43, right? And this is usually seen intellectually as kind of staking out a kind of research program where it sort of showed in reasonably clear terms how people with backgrounds in the physical sciences could actually make a difference in solving the problems of biology. And of course, during this period, the Rockefeller Foundation was putting a lot of money to getting people into this, and they were in fact funded the Cavendish Laboratories in Cambridge, where the work was actually eventually done. And so these guys were coming into this with a fairly broad horizon, right? Sort of comprehensive. They, you know, they were thinking about things at the level at which Schrödinger was thinking about it, was that we could have some kind of comprehensive, unified theory of science, right? And there may be a kind of a separate set of laws for life, right? But nevertheless, that could be understood in physical chemical terms and mathematically tractable and all the rest of it, okay? And that's what got these guys in there. So they obviously came in with a very kind of broad vision, and then of course they focused it and worked on this very particular problem, and then the problem was solved, they got the prize, and then what did they do? Well, in a sense, you start to get to see after the prize the kinds of issues that were really animating these people, okay? And there was already some allusion, you know, and the thing that's interesting about all three of them is that in their own different ways, they've all been controversial. They're all controversial. And this is not unusual for people who get the Nobel Prize and go off and do other things. They often say very controversial things and work on controversial areas. And I want to review these briefly because, in a sense, they give you different kinds of reasons why one might want to do this kind of, you know, biochemical research, molecular biology that led them to get the prize. Now, Watson was mentioned earlier today. And Watson, of course, is always seen, I think you mentioned him, I believe. Right, and to recap, for those of you who don't remember, but I remember very vividly, 10 years ago, right, when James Watson was flogging his memoirs, and he made a lecture tour of the UK, and he was supposed to speak at the Royal Society, and he was supposed to speak at the Scottish Royal Academy, but then he did an article in one of the major broadsheet newspapers in the UK. Where he was basically making the point that you were referring to, where he said that development aid was basically a waste of time on Africa for genetic reasons, okay? And then he immediately got sent back to the United States and lost all his positions, right? He became a non-person, as you put it. The interesting thing about this, though, is that if you look at... Now, he didn't handle this well, obviously. Let's grant that point. He didn't handle this well. But what he was saying, if you actually read what he was saying, okay, and so I've looked at this, this stuff, he's making the following kind of argument, okay, which unfortunately he kind of, in a way, kind of fed into a much more vulgarized version of. But the argument was basically, look, as we had, because Watson eventually became one of the guys who was pushing right, the mapping of the human genome in the United States, right, in the 1990s. He was very much behind that. And he was saying that one of the consequences of being able to map the human genome was that you would be able to find the genetic markers for various diseases, okay? And the thing is that then, not only diseases, so diseases being, you'll understand in a fairly broad eugenic kind of way, right? Deficiency, whatever, below average, right? So he's understanding it in that terms. But his point was that what this could do, it could be a big cost saver in the long run. So in other words, if you find that there are genetic markers for various sorts of things that are in some sense socially undesirable, rather than having to change society, which costs a lot of money and doesn't get the political goodwill, we might be able to have some kind of biomedical fix. We can nip this stuff in the bud much more cheaply. Okay? And it's in this context that he said development aid was a waste of money. Because he thinks, and he's probably wrong, but this is what he thought, there may be some genetic marker in these people in Africa for generations after generations don't seem to be able to raise their standards. If we just figure out what that is, we don't obliterate them. This is not what he's asking. You know, he's not saying obliterate them. Rather, we can treat them. Okay, you laugh, right? You laugh. And it's probably wrong, you know, from an empirical standpoint. But the point here is, right, he is thinking about the biological context as feeding into, you know, some kind of what he thinks of as socially responsible form of science. Because he's thinking, look, you know, we're putting a lot of money into welfare, a lot of money in development aid, what are we getting back for it? So he sees a problem right there. And so he thinks that biology is going to provide the solution to it. Okay, now you might say, oh, this is a, you know, pie in the sky, this is never going to happen, it's ridiculous. Okay, but the point is, who can say stuff like this and actually, you know, get it into a broadsheet newspaper before he gets kicked out of the country? Right, it's a Nobel Prize winner. Okay? Anyone else would have been stopped much earlier on in the process. Okay? So that's one example. Okay? Now, Morris Wilkins. Okay, let me mention Morris Wilkins. So Morris Wilkins, I don't know if you know much about this guy. He is someone who comes from the stable, at the time he was part of the DNA project, of J.D. Burnell. Okay, John Desmond Burnell, does that name mean something to people, right? So this was the great radical scientist, he was an X-ray crystallographer at the time. He's a Cambridge-trained guy. At the time, he was professor of physics at Birkbeck College, and that was where Wilkins was the understudy, basically, and he did a lot of that kind of work that was required to actually detect the structure of the DNA. Okay, so and Wilkins was working with Rosalind Franklin, right? I mean, and you know about that, she's one of these people, right, who has a difficult reputation, you might say, in Nobel circles. but the thing is that that Wilkins, okay, actually came from a tradition that was, you know, he became the guy who started this big movement, very big movement in the UK, called the British Society for Social Responsibility in Science. In fact, he was the first president, and he was the president for over 25 years. In fact, he was president from 1969 to 1991. It was only when he retired that he stopped being the president. This group in Britain, which is usually seen as kind of all, Burnell was this kind of Marxist. Just in case you don't know, Burnell was not only an X-ray crystallographer, but he was also a Marxist, and he's the person who was largely responsible for introducing what in the historiography of science is called the external history of science, the idea that the development of science is determined by social conditions. Right, Burnell is the person who introduced this into the English-speaking world through a big conference that he organized where he brought in a lot of guys from Moscow in the 1930s to London. Okay, and this became a very important kind of general feature of the way the history of science was written, I would say, until the rise of current social studies of science. Okay, so there is a kind of a tension or competition between this kind of more Marxist approach to the history of science and the kind of sociological approach represented by, let's say, Robert Merton, which is a much more internalized, right, science as a society rather than science in the society. Okay. Now, Wilkins is from the Burnell tradition, and when he becomes president of the British Society for Social Responsibility in Science, his interest and what he focuses on is the way in which biology impinges on warfare. Okay? So he's one of the first guys, even before he gets the Nobel Prize. In fact, he's being investigated by the British government up to the time that he's getting that he's doing the DNA research as a communist and someone who they thought might be selling secrets about atomic energy and so forth to the Russians. Okay, so this guy Wilkins was under surveillance for a long time, but in the 1960s he becomes the head of this, and he's the person, one of the people who promote at the public level that one should understand what the biological consequences are of nuclear war. Right? And so he's one of these unilateral disarmament guys. Right? And so he's involved with Pugwash, he's involved with all these kinds of organizations, he in fact makes all these links across. But not only that, he's also involved in other areas, you know, because given the increasingly physical impact nature of warfare in the modern period, he looks into things like tear gas. So he was responsible for a commission that eventually banned tear gas in the dealing with Northern Ireland that Britain was undergoing, right, until relatively recently, where tear gas had been used. He looked at the biological consequences of that and so forth, and actually led a commission that eventually stopped the British government from using this. Okay, so this is another kind of way in which, you know, his prestige as a Nobel Prize winner actually enabled him to do a lot of this very left-wing stuff that, in a sense, you know, other people who were merely left-wingers, right, wouldn't have the credibility to do. So among the people who you know, when Wilkins died, among the people who were most kind of praiseworthy of him, and some of you may know, you know, the Roses, Stephen and Hillary Rose, these are people who also come from this kind of camp, but these people don't have nearly the kind of prestige in the scientific circles as someone like Wilkins. Okay. Now the final guy is Crick, Francis Crick, and Crick is a guy who, in a very interesting kind of, because Crick, again, I don't know how any of you familiar with the kind of various things that Francis Crick went into? Because one of the problems was Francis Crick couldn't get a chair in genetics at Cambridge. And this helped to change his career path, but in the direction of what he, in a sense, was always animating him. It goes back to Schrödinger's initial kinds of concerns. And this is about the nature, the biological nature of consciousness. Okay? And so Crick, in his autobiography, says, look, you know, one of the things that he saw very clearly, and so now we're talking about, you know, the 1960s, that you basically have two kinds of people out there. You've got the behaviorists who deny the existence of consciousness, but actually have kind of most of the data about what people are doing. They just deny consciousness is there, right? And the neuroscientists who are in a way inhibited by the behaviorists from actually looking at any of this stuff and not really hooking up very much with the behavioral project. And so what, and in fact there was a kind of tendency to think that consciousness was somehow some kind of misperception or misapprehension of brain states. There was that kind of view floating around as well. So Crick basically said, no, look, what you have to do is bring these disciplines together and then you can have a kind of unified science of consciousness. Okay? And he actually kind of promoted some very interesting kind of research. The most famous of which was this research into blind sight. So blind sight is the idea that you can actually have, as it were, the experience of seeing without actually having eyes, right? Through some other sense, right? This is what Crick was interested in, right? The way in which consciousness, in a sense, could be multimodalized, right? So in that respect, consciousness isn't just reducible to a particular modality. So it isn't just, you know, vision through sight, you know, through eyes or hearing through ears, but rather there's a kind of notion of consciousness that in a sense can migrate across many different sensory modalities. And he was saying all of this, of course, without ever claiming to be a spiritualist or anything like that, though of course he got appropriated that way. A lot of creationists, intelligent design people, I hang around these people, right? They love this guy, Crick. Even though Crick himself is actually the originator of a lot of the kind of things that we normally regard as most abominable coming from Richard Dawkins's mouth. So this idea that religion ought to be something that only exists between consenting adults but otherwise constitutes child abuse. You've heard of this as something associated with Richard Dawkins. That's originally Francis Crick. Okay? But nevertheless, Francis Crick had this very kind of much more open-minded attitude toward consciousness, right? And the thing that was driving it all along was very much, I would say, a kind of Schrödinger-style kind of idea that if we really want to take the unity of science seriously, right, then we're not necessarily talking about a reductionist project, but we're talking about a project that brings together many different dimensions, right? If you look at what is life, that is kind of the spirit of the project, and Crick basically resumed that once he had the opportunity with regard to the Nobel Prize. In addition, you may also know, because panspermia came up, no, not how Arrhenius came up, and I always think of Arrhenius with regard to panspermia, he also had this kind of notion of directed panspermia, Crick, right? That the idea was that in some sense, it was so improbable that life could have arisen on Earth, right? In other words, the origin of life is so improbable, it had to arise somewhere else, because it was very unlikely arising on Earth, and then somehow got transported over here. Okay? Richard Dawkins also holds a view similar to this. Right? But as long as the person doing the transporting isn't God, he's okay. Okay? But the point is, this was all kind of, this was all enabled by the Nobel Prize, right? All these guys were able to move in all these directions, and even though James Watson managed to suffer this kind of ignominious fate, you know, nevertheless, yeah, I think, to be honest with you, my view about Watson is that over time, once people kind of get over this a little bit, they're going to go back to what he's been saying. And if there is any progress, because at the moment there's not that much progress with regard to genomic medicine, okay? Genomic medicine isn't really that far advanced. But should that ever happen, then I think they're going to revisit a lot of the stuff that he said, you know, 10 years ago and more. But the point is, who could actually get this kind of visibility is a Nobel Prize winner. Right? And so then, you know, you ask, so to my mind, if you look at those three guys, the kind of impact that they have, which I actually think was overall salutary in terms of opening up horizons and so forth, were not impacts that were in the discipline that they came from. It wasn't in molecular biology, right? It was in all these other things. And in fact, one of the consequences of their having this kind of more diffuse impact in all these other areas is that they actually, I think, served a very important function in terms of bringing science and society closer together. Even if in very controversial ways, they nevertheless, in a way, heightened the level of relevance of the two realms. You know, so the Nobel Prize enabled that. And that's really what I would say is a good thing. Now, I'm going to end here, but what I want to point out, and this is one of the things I mentioned in the abstract, is that I was really struck. So you look at the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, does the Nobel Peace Prize, what is the Nobel Peace Prize rewarding? Is the Nobel, you know, to what extent is it actually rewarding achievements versus aspiration? Okay? And I think that maybe the science prizes ought to be more like this. Okay? So I keep on remembering Obama. He got the Nobel Prize in 2009. For what exactly? Right? I mean, especially in light of, you know, what he then went on to do. You know, in terms of wars and things like this. And he got the Nobel Peace Prize. Remember that? Okay? And this is not the only time the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded in this kind of manner, where there is a sense in which what is being rewarded is, as it were, some level of achievement. But what's really being rewarded in terms of the profiling, in terms of the amount of resources invested into it, is a kind of aspiration. It's a much, you know, so in other words, when people complain about the Nobel Prize, they usually focus on the Peace Prize, and they say the Nobel Prize Committee is trying to push an agenda, right? People say this all the time. And I'm saying, fine. Why not? In fact, if you actually look at the important impacts that that people who get the Nobel Prize have had, it has been of this character. So, and given the way in which the prize is structured and how the nominations are taken, you know, and given the kind of looseness of the prize to begin with as a prize, I don't see why this can't be a much more upfront feature of what the Nobel Prize is about, rather than, you know, keep on pretending it's about some kind of narrow disciplinary achievement. So I'll stop there. Okay?
Contingency as historical actors, and they belong in an epoch where the belief that science and society were in an intimate relationship is much more prevalent than it is now, I would like to say. And I wonder whether they had met, the Nobel Prize was maybe a facilitator, but they would have nonetheless tried to push that agenda. And I wonder to what extent what you said about that case could be generic, enables you to make a generalization of the Nobel Prize, or is it that you are using that specific example to argue about the transformation of the Nobel system?
Yes. In a sense, if you want to know who the ideal audience is for this talk, are the guys who give the Nobel Prizes. I thought some of them might be in the room, right? I mean, but the thing is that's the ideal. Because if you look at how the prizes are structured and so forth, to my mind, you know, and you look at what has been, you know, what happens after people get the prize, then rather than talking about the fact that they move in all these different directions as somehow an interesting aberration or whatever, why not say, well, that's kind of what the prize is about, really. It's not really a discipline-based prize. It's only, in a way, it's only kind of acts. It's only because Nobel thought those disciplines rather mattered, right? I mean, I think that's quite clear, it seems to me, because I was looking at his testimony.
thought these particular disciplines actually had a lot to do with helping mankind, and that was kind of what he was coming from. That was the main reason. It wasn't that he was trying to prop up academic establishments. In fact, the whole prize is set up in kind of a way to create conflict between different sorts of academic establishments. At least, so in a way, it's a recommendation to the people getting the prize.
So
no, you want to... That's what I would say. I mean, not the only one. I mean, but I certainly, you know, when I was thinking, so when Sven invited me and I was thinking, what am I going to hit on to talk about this topic? Boom, 1962. Yeah.
I
didn't mean to blame the Nobel Prize Committee for overlooking her.
That is also true for some other, I mean, so actually it was rather quick from first nomination. Normally, already in those days, you had nominations coming much earlier. So. But I was thinking of you, since your example is here, is really that what a few of them have made out of the position of the Nobel Laureate. This is perhaps a very stupid question, but if we remove the Nobel Prize from history at all, what had science looked the same? Of course, there are other prizes out there and so on, or has the Nobel Prize in that sense, to your mind, actually proven to be so important?
That's a good question. That is a really good question. My view is that the history of science would probably have been as it was from the standpoint of the developments in science within the particular scientific disciplines, like, you know, the double helix would have been discovered even if these guys were thinking about a Nobel Prize or whatever. So I don't think the history of science would have changed very much, but I think it's this stuff that I'm talking about that would have changed a lot, right? So it's this larger social impact, and the point is it's not merely social impact, it's a kind of impact that makes it evident to people the closeness of connection between science and society. That's the key part, right? So it's not a kind of random kind of impact, you know, because, I mean, there was some suggestion, maybe it was in your talk, you know, scientists becoming celebrities and being on chat shows and stuff like that. That's not really what I'm talking about, right? What I'm talking about are people who move in directions, one of the consequences of which, it makes the link between science and society very evident and very serious, right? In a way that I don't think, if they didn't get the Nobel Prize, that wouldn't have happened.
Sometimes the rest of the Nobel system is a bit like this about what the Norwegians
say. No, I understand.
We don't know for sure. Other people might know this much better here, but sometimes we might believe that Nobel envisaged that the laureates should be younger, aspiring scientists. That is, that they should get the prize and that they should.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, you know. But this is where the whole idea of why it's called a prize, rather, you know, because rather than investment, you know, as I was preparing for this, one of the things that was crossing my mind, you know, this television show in the United States that's called The Shark Tank, and in Britain it's called Dragon's Den, right? Where these people have entrepreneurial ideas, basically, you know, and they kind of make a pitch, and they already have a prototype done or something like that. And then the guys decide who's going to get the investment. Okay? That did float through my mind. I'm not saying I'm endorsing that, but I'm saying that did cross my mind in the sense that if you want to talk about aspirational, right, then you do want to think not just what the person has already done, but what are they likely to do? Where are they going to take it? So like with these three guys who I was talking about, you kind of, you know, at least with Wilkins, you clearly knew where his mind was. Okay, and with some of these other guys, you may have as well. So, in other words, the The Nobel Committee gets all kinds of dossiers and documentation to analyze candidates and so forth. And so the interesting question is, what kinds of information do you want to take as relevant for making a decision on the prize? And so I think some of the external interests, you know, the way in which they connect their science they're doing with larger issues would be a relevant thing, I would have thought, if one wanted to take this possibility seriously. So it wouldn't be just strictly on, you know, the pure scientific merits. Yeah, yeah. You can change again. Come on, it's only 100 years. It's been around.
I do think the ones I do know about, the people have gone off in these more adventurous directions.
There are plenty of examples of that. I think you're absolutely right. From Arrhenius to...
Yeah, exactly.
Einstein and so
on. Ostwald, right?
Ostwald,
yeah.
Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I just think it's an interesting counter story.
No, I know, but I'm not so down on the Nobel Prize. I just think it needs to be rejuvenated. Go elsewhere, who kind of move into other areas. And this is sometimes this kind of thing gets criticized, though, of course, right? In fact, somebody made an allusion to this, you know, Nobel Prize winners, you know, speaking beyond their expertise, blah, blah, blah. But you know, that's kind of good, actually, especially if they're pushing controversial views and are given the space to kind of develop them in quite a good way. I think that's actually a very strong positive feature of the prize.
But why? I mean, just because you like heterodoxy. I mean, you know.
No, because because of the nature of specialized scientific research, because all these guys that I was talking about just now, I think you would say that all of them had a kind of interdisciplinary horizon at the end of the day, even though the Nobel Prize was on something quite specific in molecular biology. And I think that's the kind of thing, it's not just heterodoxy for its own sake, but it is an issue about trying to provide incentives for scientists from breaking, you know, outside the paradigms, right? So they actually, because the sum of reality or the sum of truth is you know, the whole of that is more than the sum of the paradigms, okay? And I think you need, and the problem is in the scientific system, there isn't an incentive to break out otherwise. And here, actually, there seems to be an incentive. And the scientists who have taken advantage of it have really exploited it well, even though they end up getting criticized for it.
Your argument in favor of Watson is very thin. Mm-hmm. And what you're asking.
biomedicine to back up what he's talking about, because at the moment it looks incredibly racist. I grant that. I grant that.
I can't imagine a moment in which it will not look incredibly racist. So what you're saying is no matter what the person does, as long as they're engaging in society, that's great. And I'm not sure that's what the Nobel Prize should be about.
No, I think you shouldn't be hung up by the Watson case. I think in the long term, this Watson thing may not be quite what it looks like, okay? Because like, you read what he says, not what people say about him. But what he says is he is talking about specific genetic markers. Now, he ends up in the popular press, you know, talking about in this incredibly broad swipe terms. But at the end of the day, he's talking about treating specific genetic things that happen to be correspond very often to Africans. Maybe, maybe not. Right, but that's an empirical question. Do you think there's something wrong in principle looking for genetic markers for various kinds of diseases and perhaps treating them in a medical way rather than treating them in the way we normally treat them, sociologically or economically or whatever?
I think empirically, given that we already know that the greatest diversity in the genetic pool is in Africa, to assume that you're going to find a single allele that accounts for...
I'm not standing behind his empirical claims, but I'm saying that the research heuristic is not crazy, even if his empirical example is false.
Okay, let's go to another question.
I mean, on that matter, we all come after Africa.
Sure, of course.
Let me go back to Nobel's original ideas. And it's really not the prize, it's a scholarship. He wanted to find that 35-year-old person that could 20 years salary. And this was the idea to further his development. So what has happened, we have had some of those that have relatively low wages, but most of us, you know, have high up in age. When I wrote my first book in 2010, the average age for Christ in physiology was 57, and it's rising, it's now been 63. Mm-hmm. So what do you expect from these people? So the example still that you're taking, though, is very good, Watson, Crick, and Wilkins, because Watson was only 34,
right?
Two that are younger than he was. And he continued really to develop it. And Crick's another example. Crick was 12 years older. But it took a long time to mature. He was, by the way, it was fired out. He did not get employment in Randall's in King's College, but he was taken in by Bragg at Cavendish as a canister. And you look at the Nobel lectures, you find that Wilkins talked about structured DNA. Watson, he talks about RNA and all the major development in RNA. He's enormous contributor. He contributed to messenger RNA. So he really delivered a lot after this discovery. And then Crick, of course, he speaks about genetic code. That got the prize then 5 years later. So these are excellent examples. But regrettably, most of our prize recipients, they are, I mean, milestones in the development of our science, but they are not there to produce one more contribution. They are way above 60 now, sadly.
Okay. So what are you suggesting? You sound like you're very pessimistic about the value of the Nobel Prize.
No, it serves another purpose. I mean, it will never serve the purpose that Nobel was aiming at, or further in the development of an individual who had done something very important. It's become the hallmark defining the progress of our science. And it is a remarkable way to get access to the public, to talk public science to the public, and that's exactly what we're doing here.
I know, but don't you think that's a very expensive way of going about doing it? I mean, I know, with all due respect, if that's all the Nobel Prize does, is just to promote the public understanding of science, that can be done a lot more cheaply, and it's done probably as effectively by the people in this room.
I'm not sure about that, because we hear examples here of how you can use these Nobel laureates as really beacons to describe what science is all about. Why it's such an exciting endeavor, what all the enthusiasm, why do you commit your life to this? These are great.
And this is worth the prize?
It's definitely worth the prize. We all as human beings, we have our role models, and if we can be stimulated by such a role model.
But you make it sound like it's so hard to sell science. Really, that unless you have a Nobel Prize winner getting how many millions of dollars, you know, that's not going to happen.
No, but it's a matter of trying to understand what it's all about, to get an insight into science, into the unique culture of science. That I think is important. That's why I write my book. What is the creative environment? It's individual, it's a physical environment, but what is it ticks it off, that makes this remarkable discovery. All by sudden, something new that no one has seen, and when people that call the excited look at that and say, yes, that's the way it is. Why didn't I see that? And what will you see down the road 50 years from now? Same thing. Why didn't we see that? So this is the most fantastic culture we have. So I think technology is a prime mover of our society. That's the truth of the matter.
Well, I agree with that. It's just whether it takes so much money to give to people for
it's cheap. But the Nobel is you can't deny it. It's a success.
Well, it certainly is, yeah.
And that's the reason why that is. That's because it's been taken so seriously by Swedish colleagues trying to keep up to date with the science, trying to be objective, probably influenced by the Lutheran trade and so forth. And producing remarkably objective and analytical reviews that has on the platform by which you can make the selection. It's worked well done, and it's thanks to people like T.C. Eliot or all these that build this fantastic press, and we profit from it today.
Can I go back to your, I don't know if it's an accurate description, but of the novel as a wild card to be spent. I think that's certainly interesting in the case of Watson, Crick, and Wilkins, but at least from my understanding, especially of the public, of the activity of Nobel in the public sphere, I see a certain diversity. So, for example, I found useful another concept of Goffman, which is the role distance. There are many ways to be a Nobel in the public sphere. So you have, of course, you have that case, which probably is a bit extreme, but very, very interesting. But then you have, for example, when I interviewed Hiroshi Amano, the Nobel Prize for Lead in 2014, he described that, and that's very interesting. I think Merkman says something about that. The prize is an accelerator. So he does the same thing he used to do, but much quicker. So the funding, the projects, everything goes faster, and of course also it's fun. Then you have, of course, the politically committed, like Pauling, or like partly Wilkins, or Salvador Luria. I mean, the day after he gets the prize, he receives a telegram from the President of the United States, Nixon, and congratulates, and he responds the same day, say, oh, thank you, but could you stop the war in Vietnam? So it's immediately using this wild card in another way. So I think there is a variety of ways in which you can use. I don't know whether the investment analogy is useful, because the investment, you have to propose the project before, while probably it's only after the Nobel that these people feel themselves free. I have
mixed feelings about it as well, but I do think that when you do have these very driven people who are already being considered for something like a Nobel Prize, there's usually more there than just technical interest, okay? It's already there. There's a hinterland, a kind of intellectual hinterland. At least that's what I believe. I think with the 1962 guys, I think that was very clearly the case. And you could, that could be something looked into as part, I'm saying, as part of the criteria by which you make a decision. Including who you include, right? Because there's always this issue with the Nobel Prize, and how many of these guys you include, right? And what's the cutoff point exactly? Mm-hmm. And that could, work in this kind of context as well. I would like to see what I regard as kind of the positive unintended consequence of the Nobel Prize to actually be rolled into part of what the prize is actually about.
One last. Yes,
sir.
I think you're trying to solve two things in two dimensions. One is, at the end of the 19th century, there was a problem of specialization. Mm-hmm. And this was partly solved by research councils, Cassidy Research and others. And perhaps by Nobel also, maybe his intention was to correct that. What you say now is that this problem may be solved by this wide spreading people like Rick Watson, et cetera, with going into many disciplines. So they treat, in a sense, the problem of specialization. But there's another kind of dimension, and that is the one of theoretical research and research that leads to something good. society that Nobel also intended. So going from theoretical research into more practical aspects. So you have these two dimensions that may be treated or not by the kind of presentation you spoke about.
Yeah, no, that's true. Though I always find very striking that in the history of the Nobel Prize winners, I keep on thinking of all the Nobel Prize winners who, in effect, I guess Fritz Haber would be an exception, but so many of them talk about the ways of curtailing or preventing or inhibiting or stopping the spread of the science that they're part of from doing horrible things. So many of them actually get involved in that side of the business, right? Which is, in a sense, part of the technological, you know, thinking about what the technological implications are. It isn't necessarily always about application. It could also be about, you know, constraining, right? And if you really understand the science well, then you're actually in a very authoritative position to say what you should and should not do, let's say, in warfare, you know, with regard to nuclear stuff and things like that. And so their Haber is kind of an outlier in that regard. But I am struck by that too, right? That there's that aspect of the Nobel Prize winners when it comes to the issue of the technological application. They're often the ones talking about the constraint that needs to be exercised. Because they, in a sense, I suppose, they understand the science well. They can see the possibilities kind of in a way in which, you know, the kind of people who would be impressed by such weapons and things would not see.
One more?
You know what Harvard did?
What
Harvard actually did when he got the prize? He tried to develop a method to extract gold from seawater in order to pay the war debt.
Ah.
And then he also developed cyclone.
Yeah. I was alluding to that part. Yeah.
But that was pretty easy.
Okay. Yeah.
So you did try to do some
good. Yes, no, 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 no. It